Okay. I just want to welcome everybody to the ADA Legal Webinar Series. Today's session is on post-secondary and professional licensing and testing issues. And just want to do a little bit of housekeeping before I start the session. My name is Claudia Diaz, and I'm with the Great Lakes ADA Center. And wanted to identify once again, if you missed it, we do have captioning available for this session. To access the captioning, click on the CC icon found at the top. For this session, we do not have microphones for the participants, and we ask that you submit your questions in the chat area during the question and answer time that Barry and Alan have designated for us. So just hold your questions until then. The other thing I want to identify is the emotion icons. Please do not use those as they are distracting for some of our participants and also for the presenters. So if you can hold off on using those, that would be greatly appreciated. To get started, I want to welcome everybody and welcome our presenters. Barry Taylor, who is the Legal Advocacy Director for Equip for Equality. And we have Alan Goldstein, who is the senior attorney for Equip for Equality as well. Most of us are familiar with Alan and Barry, who have been working with the center for quite a bit and have been doing these seminars, webinars for about 2 years, 3 years. So they're a regular house name for us. So I just want to transfer it over to them and welcome them to the session and say thank you in advance for all the hard work you've been putting into the session.
Great. Thanks, Claudia. This is Barry, and I'm going to go first. Welcome, everybody. We're going to be talking today about post-secondary education and licensing under the ADA, a really interesting couple of issues. And we're going to be focusing on four main points, and I'm going to cover the first two, and then Alan will cover the second two. So the first two issues will be basically going over the general requirements of the ADA and providing reasonable accommodations and modifications under Titles 2, 3, and Section 504, and then spending most of the time on the cases that look at these issues that come up at school as well as on licensing tests. We'll then open it up to see if people have any questions, and then Alan is going to cover a couple more issues, cases involving the expulsion of college students with mental illness, and also the required disclosure of medical treatment on professional licensing applications. So this is when you apply to become some sort of professional. And interestingly, there's been some recent cases that have come down just in the last month or two. So while we didn't know this when we were planning this session for this time, it is quite timely. And just a reminder that this session is eligible for those of you who are attorneys living in Illinois for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. And if you are applying for that, you can email me directly, barryt@equipforequality.org, and we'll have this slide at the end of the session as well. So just real quickly, by way of background, public colleges and entities are covered under Title II of the ADA, and they're also covered on both private and public universities are covered under the Rehabilitation Act if they receive federal funding. And sorry, my phone is ringing. There is an anti-discrimination provision under Title II. And you'll see there on the slide, no qualified individual with a disability shall, by reason of such disability, be excluded from participation in or be denied the benefits of the services, programs, or activities of that public entity. And that's the basic standard under all Title II cases, including ones involving universities. Some unique things about Title II that you won't see with respect to Title III covering private universities are requirements from the regulations of appointing an ADA 504 coordinator, having a self-evaluation and transition plan, providing notice of accessibility, and also having an internal grievance procedure. In many of these situations, it requires the entity to have 50 or more employees, so this doesn't apply to all Title II entities. But we will be talking about the self-evaluation and transition plan and whether or not that is an issue that a private person can enforce or not in a later case. One other quick issue to think about is there were a lot of cases earlier and right after the turn of the century. One of the main ones involving the ADA was whether or not you could sue state employers for cases under the ADA for money damages. And the Garrett case, the court said you can't sue because state employers are immune from suits for money damages. You can get non-monetary relief, but not monetary relief. And then after that, there's a case that's not on the slide, Lane versus Tennessee, or Tennessee versus Lane, where the court looked at Title II. The Garrett case was Title I for employment. And in Title II, instead of saying whether or not you could sue under Title II generally like they did in Garrett, they just said that case only involved courthouse access. And they said, well, courthouse access is a fundamental right, and those are ones where we should allow people with disabilities to sue for money damages. But what the court left open was, what about other Title II entities other than courthouses? And so on this slide, there are two cases going both ways with respect to state licensing boards, which we'll be talking about further in the session. And as you'll see, the Haysom case from the Ninth Circuit, the court said that state licensing boards aren't immune for cases for money damages under Title II. But state licensing boards were found to be immune from money damages in a case that was decided later by the Seventh Circuit. So clearly the law has not been determinative on this, and it's maybe an issue that gets up to the Supreme Court later as there are more conflicts in the circuit. Oops, sorry about that. And then this just lays out Title III's anti-discrimination requirements, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, basically not discriminating in the full and equal enjoyment of goods, services, facilities, and privileges or accommodations of private businesses. And that can be through contractual licensing or other arrangements. And discrimination can include denying participation, unequal or separate benefits, or improper eligibility criteria. And it can also include failing to make reasonable accommodations or modifications in policies, practices, and procedures. You'll hear the terms modifications and accommodations used interchangeably, and basically they mean the same thing. Accommodations is typically under Title I, but you'll hear it used sometimes in Title II and III. But generally, modifications or accommodations for our purposes today are synonymous. And of course, Title III, as within Title II, entities have the defense that if they can show that the changes that are being requested would somehow cause an undue burden or fundamentally alter the nature of the services, the accommodation or modification doesn't have to be provided. And we'll talk more about how the courts have interpreted that issue. And Title III, the regulations talk specifically about licensing examinations and courses. So this is clear that the Department of Justice, when they were interpreting Title III, wanted to make sure that it was clear that Title III did cover these types of scenarios and that they apply to the administrative methods, the eligibility requirements, modifications to policies, practices, and procedures, as well as providing auxiliary aids and services like a sign language interpreter. The regulations also say that the examinations or courses related to applications, licensing, certification, or credentialing shall offer the examinations in an accessible place and manner. And it goes on and say that they must accurately reflect the person's aptitude or achievement level or whatever factor the examination is trying to measure rather than reflecting the individual's impairment. And then also goes on to talk about the auxiliary aids and the fundamental alteration that I referenced earlier. These next two slides give some examples of reasonable modifications that can come up in the education or licensing scenario. So, for instance, extra time on test or course completion, a lot of litigation around extended time for testing. Other issues that can come up involve alternate sites or method for testing or providing materials, allowing the use of assistive technology, providing note takers, as well as providing readers. Move to the next slide. Other reasonable modifications could include a fragrance or distraction-free environment, barrier removal, providing auxiliary aids and services, again, unless there's an undue burden. And some examples, again, include materials in alternate formats, sign language interpreters, or the acquisition or modification of equipment or devices. Next slide. Sorry, just moving them. Okay. This slide talks about some of the issues that come up for reasonable modification and accommodation. And one of the biggest issues we've seen in litigation was who gets the reasonable modifications and accommodations. And what that raises is, does the person have a disability under the ADA? And if they do have a disability, are they qualified for the service they're seeking? And we'll talk about what the courts that have interpreted that. Another issue coming up that we've referenced already is, do you have to provide the reasonable modification or accommodation if there's some sort of fundamental alteration? And what does that mean? And then under fundamental alteration, some of the issues that can come up about modifying eligibility requirements and the perceived fairness or unfairness to others who don't get these modifications. The other thing that has come up is that personal devices and services are not required, and some examples of personal devices and services that aren't required to be provided by Title II and Title III entities include wheelchairs, prescription eyeglasses, hearing aids, personal services such as assistance in eating, toileting, and dressing. Next slide. So the first issue that I referenced before is, does the person have a disability? And as within an ADA case, that's really where you start. And for all of you know, the definition of disability includes, does the person have a substantial limitation in a major life activity? And one of the core issues that has come up is, when you look at substantial limitation, are you comparing students to an average person or to an average student? Because if you're doing an average person, it's going to be different than if you're looking at an average student as far as the accomplishments of those types of folks. And there are a lot of cases, I'm not sure if we referenced this at the beginning, but in addition to this PowerPoint, you'll also be receiving a legal brief, which has much more detailed analysis, and there are a lot of cases in the legal brief which show how many people over the years have been unable to get modifications on exams or in post-secondary education because they couldn't prove they had a disability. And that was because, in many situations, because the courts had interpreted the ADA's definition of disability very narrowly. And as a result, many people weren't found to be disabled, and then if you're not found to be disabled, then you wouldn't be entitled to the accommodation. The Love case is a good example of one of those cases. This was a case brought against the Law School Admissions Council, and it was a student who had ADHD as well as a learning disability, and the student had sought additional time on a law school admission test. And the court looked at the person's past test scores and educational history, and they found that they weren't substantially limited in the major life activity of learning. And in that case, they had relied on the old definition of disability, or the old interpretation of the definition of disability, particularly the Supreme Court case in Toyota, where they said you should look at substantial limitation very narrowly, and you have to show that you are actually prevented or severely restricted in some major life activity to meet the definition of disability. And in this case, they found that the student was not prevented or severely restricted in the activities of learning, and they looked at the student's past success in education, and they definitely looked, they did not compare him to the average of student, but instead to the average person. And what's good, I think, is that now the new ADA Amendments Act rejects this narrow analysis, and therefore the past interpretations that have limited so many people from getting accommodations won't be used, but instead a broader definition of disability will be used, and then it'll get to more whether it's reasonable or not, instead of looking at whether or not the person has a disability or not. I think this case was difficult as well because the student did not have any past history of getting accommodations in any other context, like on the ACT or the SAT or during college or during high school. And so this was the first time he had asked for an accommodation, and that, I think, hurt him in that situation. We are awaiting regulations on the ADA Amendments Act to give us even more information about how it's to be interpreted. The EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, has taken the lead on issuing the first set of regulations, and those are currently pending and should be issued shortly, I understand. And our understanding is then the Department of Justice will issue its own recommendations on the interpretations of the ADA Amendments Act, but it's believed that they will be adopting the interpretations that the EEOC has done, and as the EEOC has taken the lead on that. So we shall see. For those of you who haven't participated in these webinars before, there is a way for us to sort of do some polling and see what you think about some of these issues. And so our first polling question is, do you believe that the ADA Amendments Act will result in more students getting accommodations? If you think yes, you can check the green box, which is in the top, or the green check mark, which is in the top box. If you think no, you can click the red X, and then Alan will press a button, and then we'll see what people think.
And those that are using screen reader users, you can do the key combination control 1 for yes, control 2 for no. And the green checkbox is found in the participant section at the bottom of your, under the names. So green check for yes, red X for no, or keyboard combination control 1 for yes, control 2 for no.
Thanks, Claudia. And it looks like those of you who voted, 48%, think that we'll have more accommodations. 2% said no, and then about half of you didn't vote at this time. So those of you who did vote seems clearly to think that we're going to be seeing more accommodations for students. And certainly the ADA we expect to be interpreted in a more broad manner, and that should lead to more accommodations. But as I said before, even after you prove that you have a disability, you still have to show that you're entitled to the accommodation, that it's reasonable and not some sort of undue burden or fundamental alteration. So there will be more steps, but certainly we'll see more people with being found to have a disability and getting to further along in their case. And I saw a couple people raising their hand, and my understanding is we're not using that tool, so if you could refrain from pressing that button, we'd appreciate it. Another issue that I referenced before, in addition to whether you have a disability, is whether you're qualified or not. And this is something that's expressly listed in Title II. It's not expressly listed in Title III, but it comes up a lot in some of the case analysis, and is listed in Section 504. And qualified means that you're qualified with or without the accommodation or the modification to meet whatever eligibility requirements are involved. So, for instance, you're applying to college. You have to have a high school degree, and maybe for a particular college you have to score a certain amount, number on the ACT or SAT, or you have to have taken certain courses. And those are, you have to show that you reach those, and even if you've been treated differently because of your disability, if you can't show you're qualified or that you're eligible with or without the modification that you've requested, whether you've been treated differently becomes irrelevant. So you have to show you have a disability, show you're qualified, and then you get to the issues of reasonableness and discrimination. And there's a couple examples on this next slide involving qualified. I mean, the general rule is that educational institutions don't have to lower their academic standards for a professional degree, and courts have been very deferential to educational institutions about what academic standards they set, as long as they apply those consistently. And the Millington case listed here involved a dental student who couldn't meet the eligibility requirements even with accommodations that they had requested, and so they were deemed not qualified under Title II as well as the Rehab Act. And then the Mershon case involved a student with cerebral palsy, also had a visual impairment and used a wheelchair, and could not meet the academic requirements once they were in school. And so because they couldn't meet the academic requirements, I think they had a GPA that was below 2.0, they were not qualified, and they're able to bring a case under the ADA. And in that case, to show the deference to the university, the court said, when requested accommodations involves an academic decision, courts should show great respect for the faculty's professional judgment. So courts have been very deferential on that issue. Now we're going to look at some cases involving policy modifications and fundamental alteration. And the Mershon case that we talked about on the last slide showed an example of this. This was a student who needed an accommodation of early registration so that they could get disability benefits check and help to pay for tuition. And the court said that is a modification that the university should have provided and was not a fundamental alteration. And then we see a case that's similar to many cases that have been filed in this arena, and that's the Powell case versus the National Board of Medical Examiners. And that's there's a requirement that you take certain board tests. They're called STEP tests, the United States Medical Licensing Examination. And you have to, after your second year of medical school, you have to pass the first step of this test to go on to the third year of medical school. And this was involving the University of Connecticut. And they weren't able to pass it. And the court said that that policy of not permitting somebody to go to the third year of medical school if they haven't passed this licensing examination was a reasonable policy, and it would be a fundamental alteration to change that policy. And they showed that they had been providing accommodations to the student for a couple years during the first 2 years of medical school. The case also involved whether or not the student should have been entitled to extended time on the actual medical licensing examination, and in this case, they said that it was not required. We're actually going to talk about a couple of other cases involving this issue further into the PowerPoint. Okay, somehow we got to the end. I'm sorry. That was my fault. I think I pressed the wrong arrow.
Hey, Barry, I'll jump you back.
Okay, sorry about that. Go to 18.
Okay, here, can you let me stop clicking out? Okay.
Okay, sorry about that, everyone. This next case is talking about policy modifications and funding alteration that we've talked about before. Before I mention that case, I did want to mention, for those of you in Chicago, you might have seen in the Chicago Tribune, and this may have gone nationally as well, a complaint that's been filed against Northwestern University, and I believe also New York University, on behalf of folks who are blind. It's the National Federation of the Blind, because both these universities are apparently using Google applications, and there are concerns that the Google applications are inaccessible to people who are blind, and because they don't turn text into synthesized speech or braille, as well as other applications. And so that's an example of the kind of issue that can come up in these contexts. And Northwestern, I haven't seen a response by them, but one of the things they could say is, well, to change this whole program might be a fundamental alteration. We'll have to wait and see what response we get there. But that's a complaint that was filed with the Department of Justice, announced in the papers today. The case we want to talk about next is a case out of Michigan involving Oakland University. And this was a student who had cognitive impairments, and apparently Oakland University has a non-degree program that's provided for university students with disabilities. But the school had a policy that limited its on-campus housing only to students who were in degree programs. And because the plaintiff was in a non-degree program, he wasn't allowed to live in a campus dormitory. The school argued it would be a fundamental alteration to allow a student to live in a campus dorm if they're not in the degree program, and so he ended up suing under Title II, as well as the Rehab Act and the Fair Housing Act, seeking a modification of this policy. And the court said, you know, even though this disability, this rule on its face violate the ADA, it's disability neutral. It says that only on campus or degree students can live on campus. In campus housing, it did have a disparate impact on students with disabilities, and therefore they found that there was discrimination here. The court noted that the university hadn't made an individualized inquiry. They rejected the fundamental alteration argument. The school had made an argument that it would be a change in the culture by having non-degree students in on-campus housing, and also impede students seeking degrees. And the court said, you know, even though the student was a non-degree student, they contributed to the academic purpose of the school. He was actively engaged with professors and fellow students, and they really found that this argument by the university was grounded in prejudice, stereotypes, and unfounded fear, and there was no reason why a non-degree student with a disability should be prohibited from living in on-campus housing, especially when you have this non-degree program as part of the overall programs at the university. Another case involving whether accommodations are effective in school, there's numerous ones of these. The first one we're going to talk about is the Dilella case, and that was a student who had a learning disability, and the student had sought accommodations, but the ones that were provided weren't effective, and the case isn't clear on what accommodations the student was seeking, but the school had provided some accommodations already: double time to complete examinations, a separate quiet testing room, also extended time on written projects. They had also provided a note taker, although the school later changed the note taking to transcriptions, and the transcriptions weren't provided in a timely fashion. So the question here was whether or not the school had discretion to provide, had provided an effective accommodation or not. And you might remember talking about effective accommodations in the context of employment. And the court here sort of borrowed from the Title I regulations that talked about that schools have discretion, or employers have discretion, to provide accommodations that what they feel is the most effective. They don't have to provide the preferred accommodation, and that's being applied here in the school context as well. And here the court said there was a question of fact as to whether or not the school had really provided an effective accommodation, and one of the main issues was the failure to provide these transcriptions in a timely fashion. So again, the whole concept of providing an effective accommodation or modification is applying here in the school context, and again, students aren't necessarily entitled to the preferred accommodation, but they are entitled to an effective accommodation, and the court found here there was at least a question of fact whether it was effective, and therefore the case could continue. Another case involving effective accommodations in school is one out of California. The next slide is Hayden, and this was involving a student who was deaf, and he had received some interpreting and services, but there was concerns about the quality of the interpreters, and then also there were concerns about the availability. They weren't able to have an interpreter for every class for him. And the college did try to find other interpreters. They explored some other options as well. And the student said, you know, if you would let me help select the interpreter, that would help the process. And the school said, you know, we find that would be an undue burden, administrative burden, to have you involved in that process. They were also concerned about the financial issues involved. They looked at their own disability service department budget and said that 7% of the budget was being used to pay for this one student's interpreters, and they felt that that would be the basis for an undue burden defense. And the student said that he felt like only live qualified interpreters were sufficient, and so he filed suit under Title II and the Rehabilitation Act. And the court found that there were factual disputes which would require the case to go forward. The first one was whether or not the auxiliary aids that were offered were effective. The school said, well, you know, he can lip read. Maybe he doesn't need an interpreter. And the court said that, you know, whether or not the ADA's equally effective communication standard is being met is really something that the trier of fact, the judge or jury, needs to decide, and therefore it's a factual issue and the case should go forward. The court also found that the getting the student input issue, whether that's an undue administrative burden, was also a question of fact, because the interpreting for students does require special skills, and they found that the student's input may be necessary to really render it an effective auxiliary aid. And then the court also found that there's a factual dispute as to the undue hardship argument, whether or not that 7% of the disability services budget was rendered an undue hardship. But what they indicated was that you shouldn't really do what the university was doing, was only looking at the department budget. You should look broader than that. And they talked about some of the factors you probably remember from some of the Title I cases involving undue hardship, that you look at the overall size of the program. You look at the type of program involved, the nature and the cost of the accommodation needed, as well as the overall financial resources of the parent corporation. So the court was inferring that you look beyond the disability services budget and look to the broader budget of the university. And so the case went forward. Another case involving effective accommodations in school is the Hoffman case. And this is a case involving a student who had a multiple sclerosis. And the student had been given extra time on exams, had been given a quiet space for taking exams, and use of what are called formula sheets for math courses. But the college was not willing to provide her some other accommodations, including using personal notes and other materials during closed book examinations. And the Ninth Circuit found that the college did not violate the ADA nor the Rehab Act, because what the college had provided were reasonable, they were effective accommodations. And again, this reiterates the point that an effective accommodation need not be the specific accommodation requested by the student, again, consistent with the Title I case law out there. Next slide. This case, the Huezo case, also out of California, raises an interesting issue, and this case involved a student who used a wheelchair and had identified a lot of accessibility issues, including parking, sidewalks, desks, classrooms, and gym facilities. And one of the things the student pointed out when he filed suit was that the school had not complied with Title II's requirement to do a self-evaluation, which is in the Title II regulations that I pointed out at the beginning of the session. And so the student was arguing that by failing to comply with the self-evaluation, if they had done that self-evaluation, they would have identified all these inaccessibility issues, and that was one of the legal issues that he raised in court. And the court said, you know, we're not really sure if there's a private right of action if an individual can enforce the self-evaluation regulations. This may be something that's limited to the Department of Justice. But they ended up not deciding whether or not a private individual can enforce the self-evaluation regulations. They said it really wasn't necessary to decide that because it was really just one of the factors that were relevant to see whether the program's services and facilities were accessible. And they held that while the school didn't comply with the self-evaluation regulations, they went further and said that, you know, the school really failed to take any kind of affirmative steps to ensure accessibility, and that the plaintiff had made several complaints. And I think this is this scenario where plaintiffs win when universities fail to respond timely or at all usually results in the plaintiff much more likely being victorious. In cases where you see the university doing something and providing some accommodations, the courts have been more deferential. But here it appeared that the school really failed to take affirmative steps initially and then failed to respond when complaints were made. Just some general information about entrance exam accommodations. Most accredited post-secondary education programs do require applicants to submit scores from standardized tests like the SAT or the ACT as a way to objectively compare them to other applicants. And typically, these standardized tests are run by private companies, meaning covered by Title III. There are concerns that these tests can be biased against people whose impairments limit them in learning or in test-taking skills. And so what happens is the company assesses how the person's impairment relates to the skills and functions involved in the particular test. And on this slide listed are a couple of common scenarios. One is the scenario of getting the exam in maybe in large print or alternate formats, such as Braille, and also ensuring that the test-taking site is accessible. And those are typically accommodations that people are able to get usually without litigation, but when they have had to file litigation, they've been successful. The cases that have been much more contentious and where there's been more litigation and more differences in the courts has been when people are asking for things like a separate testing setting or extended time. And those are being seen by courts as more extensive accommodations and therefore more challenging in the interpretation. Typically, the private company is making its own assessment as to whether or not the accommodation should be provided. And in most cases, the testing entities are looking for not only documentation of the disability, but also documentation as to why that particular disability requires that particular accommodation. And as referenced before, there have been cases involving entrance exams for the LSAT for law school, as well as the MCAT for medical school. A kind of related issue to these entrance examinations is the issue of flagging test scores where the person has gotten some kind of accommodation. There are concerns that that may raise ADA implications when a school sees that the person's score has a flag on it, indicates that the person had some accommodation and revealing that the person has a disability. And it's not clear whether or not this flagging is an ADA violation. There is a case, Doe versus National Board of Medical Examiners, that raised this issue, but ultimately the court said it was not going to decide that issue because the person had passed the exam and had been admitted, and therefore they couldn't show that they had been prejudiced by the flagging, and therefore the court said they didn't have standing to sue that. They didn't have any kind of injury that could be addressed by the ADA. Interestingly, though, several of the testing programs, the ACT, the SAT, and the GMAT, have decided to discontinue flagging of the scores, and this may signal more widespread discontinuance of flagging. At the bottom of this slide, there is a reference to a law review article. I guess there's several law review articles on this topic that are in the brief that you'll be receiving. One of them, I think, has a very interesting title, "The Fable of the Timed and Flagged LSAT. Do Law School Admissions Committees Want the Tortoise or the Hare?" So if you're interested in this issue, there are additional resources in the brief that you can review. looking at some of the cases involving entrance examinations, the Rothberg case is a case involving somebody who applied for an accommodation in taking the law school admissions test. This was a student who had been diagnosed with a learning disability at a very early age. He had received special education services throughout high school. He had received extended time on in-class tests and written assignments. When he applied for college, he had received extra time to take the ACT because of his learning disability. And then once he was in college, he had gotten extended test time and note-taking services as accommodations throughout college. Then when it was time to take the LSAT, he requested similar accommodations for that. But the entity that administers the LSAT felt that the documentation was incomplete as well as out of date. He ended up taking the LSAT the first time and scored in the low average range. And after that first test, he was reevaluated and submitted new results. And I said he, I'm sorry, this is a woman who was doing this, for her second accommodation application for the LSAT. You can take it more than once. After the second after this new evaluation, she was diagnosed with developmental expressive writing disorder and developmental arithmetic disorder. So unlike just sort of the generic learning disability, she had some very specific disorders that had been identified through this newer evaluation. So they provided that additional information to the company that administers the LSAT, and they were again they denied the request, which resulted in the lawsuit. And the court found that this documentation that was provided, particularly the second round of documentation, was sufficient. The court also relied on the fact that there was a long history of the person having a disability and having accommodations all the way back to when being diagnosed at a very early age with learning disability and getting special education services. So unlike one of the cases we talked about before, where the first time they'd ever asked for an accommodation was when they took the graduate test or licensing exam, this is a person who had a long history, and the court was much more receptive to that person getting an accommodation on the test. The National Board of Medical Examinations, examiners I referred to before, have had a significant number of litigation filed against them for these issues on getting accommodations on their licensing examinations. And basically, as I referenced before, medical students have to take different medical licensing examinations as they go through medical school. And typically, a second-year medical student can't move on to the third year unless they pass that step one test. And the first case we filed in federal court after I started at Equip for Quality was actually against the National Board of Medical Examiners, involving a medical student who had a long history of a learning disability. She had gotten accommodations in college as well as in medical school, and the National Board of Medical Examiners still did not recognize that she had a learning disability and refused to provide her with the accommodations she had sought of extra time. And so we had to file suit for her to get that examination, extra time on her examination for the step one test. And ultimately, after we filed suit, they settled and provided that accommodation. Interestingly, when she applied to take the test the second year for the step two and asked for the same accommodation, they again denied the fact that she had a disability and again denied the accommodation. We had to refile in federal court, and again they settled. But it was a very contentious scenario. The Rush case on this next slide is really similar to the scenario we had, except they didn't settle. And so you had the court find that there was irreparable injury if the person wasn't given the additional time on the licensing examination. On the next slide, the Jenkins case is important to know. It's another case against the National Board of Medical Examiners. What was interesting about this case is the timing of the accommodation request. It was actually before the person had, or before the effective date of the ADA Amendments Act. It was before January 1st, 2009. And they argued that the more because the accommodation was going to be after the effective date, the more broad view of disability interpretation of disability should be applied. And so the question was whether or not you would retroactively apply this broader standard to this case. And the court said, well, since they weren't seeking money damages for past discrimination, but instead seeking something in the future that would happen after the effective date, it was required for the National Board of Medical Examiners to provide the accommodation in the future, even though the actual denial had been prior to the effective date of the ADA Amendments Act. But hopefully all these cases against the National Board of Medical Examiners will become much more, either less frequent, not only because of the ADA Amendments Act, but also because of a recent settlement that was reached by the Department of Justice. This is a case that was brought on behalf of a medical student at Yale who had dyslexia, who was seeking double time and a separate testing area, and the National Board of Medical Examiners had denied the student the accommodation. They said he didn't even have a disability, and they, again, had compared him to the average person and said because of all the achievements he had done as a student, he was not substantially limited in the major life activity of reading or learning. But ultimately, the Department of Justice actually settled this case with the National Board of Medical Examiners, and what I think is most important for our purposes today is that in the settlement, the National Board of Medical Examiners agreed not only to provide this accommodation to the student involved, but also agreed to some broader systemic changes that will be hopefully helpful when other people apply for accommodations in the future and won't get some of the denials that have been given before. The agreement says that the National Board can only be required to request documentation about the existence of the person's impairment, about the substantial limitation, and how the impairment limits the person's ability to take the test. And then, I think more importantly, the agreement says that the board will be required to carefully consider the recommendations of qualified professionals that they may not have carefully considered in the past, and also consider all evidence indicating whether the person is able, what they really are limited in with respect to the ADA and the ADA Amendments Act. And while the agreement goes on to say that while they don't have to defer to the recommendations of the individual's medical professional, they must give an explanation as to why they are declining to accept the recommendation. So it requires sort of an affirmative explanation as to why the person's medical professional's recommendation should not be followed. And I think this is a great example of the excellent enforcement that the Department of Justice has been doing under the current administration. And again, this is something that's been a concern of a lot of people with disabilities and people who are medical students for many years, and now I think the settlement will provide a lot more guidance and assistance for folks. With respect to licensing examinations, law students kind of face a different set of issues because the law bar exams are administered by states. And so, therefore, it's not one broad entity like the National Board of Medical Examiners, but state by state involved. And as with other tests, extended time requests are the most common issue of litigation here. And the requests for changes to the scoring exam, which is another issue that comes up, have typically been denied by courts as unreasonable. So those cases students typically lose, but it's the cases where they're seeking extended time requests that have been some wins and some losses for people with disabilities. So we have another polling question for you here, and it's a pretty broad question, but it says, do students who get extra time or other accommodations due to a disability, do you feel they have an unfair advantage? If you think yes, you can click the green check. If you think no, the red X, and control 1 if you think yes, if you're using a keyboard, and control 2 if you believe that they're not getting an unfair advantage. And Alan will tell us the results here in a second. And so those of you who voted overwhelmingly feel that people are not getting an unfair advantage by getting accommodations, which I would agree with as well. And certainly there are folks, I suppose, who try to fool the system, but I think there are certainly checks and balances in place that can address people who have somehow improperly tried to seek an accommodation that people with disabilities are entitled to under the law. The last case I wanted to mention is another very recent case. This came out in January, and this was a case involving a law student, a law graduate, it was a case involving a law school graduate who was legally blind, and the State Bar Association had agreed to allow him to use a laptop with assistive technology, but the National Bar Organization had refused to allow him to use that. He had already been granted some testing accommodations like extra time and hourly breaks and a private room, but he had also sought this laptop with assistive technology that would allow him to better understand the test. And this case went up to the appellate court, and they agreed with the lower court that the law school graduate should be allowed to use the laptop and the assistive technology on the laptop. And they found that the accommodations did not, the accommodations that had previously been granted had not really made the examination accessible to the plaintiff or provide really an effective communication for him as required under Title III. And what's really interesting here is the court focuses on a Title III regulation that says that the examination must be administered so as to best ensure that the examination results accurately the individual's aptitude or achievement level. And so what the court said is they looked at that best ensure standard and said that the accommodations the plaintiff was seeking would not make the exam accessible because she would still be suffering eye fatigue, disorientation, and nausea. The National Board had argued that the plaintiff's success on previous standard tests without the assistive technology demonstrated that the bar exam was accessible, but the court said in actuality, if you look at the facts, the plaintiff's disability had progressed since he had taken those other tests, and that testing accommodations should not be locked in, and they should really be a fluid process, an interactive process, and they should advance as technology had progressed, and there had been new technology which allowed better software for this individual that he hadn't requested before. And again, because his disability had progressed, his vision had gotten worse, there was a need for a new type of accommodation he hadn't needed before. Okay, so this is where we're going to take a break and quickly see if people have any questions. If so, you can type those in the chat box, and Alan and I will attempt to answer those, and then we'll turn it over to Alan. You just type in the chat box if you have any questions. And if you don't, we'll have time for questions at the end as well for these issues as well as the ones Alan covered. Well, we're not seeing.
There was one question that came in earlier. I thought I saw one.
Yeah, there was one that came in asking the final outcome of the Redwoods Community College case, and I actually responded to that person directly that defendant's motion for summary judgment was denied. I'm not sure what happened after that. There wasn't a subsequent decision, so maybe the party settled. But in terms of the case, defendant's motion to dismiss or for summary judgment was denied.
Yeah, they found there were fact questions that required the case to go forward.
Okay.
All right, well, why don't we turn over to Alan, and then we'll have time for questions on these issues as well as the one that he covers.
Okay, well, thank you, Barry and Claudia, and thank you, everyone who's participating. I'm going to address some different issues than Barry, and there's not a lot of case law on some of these, although there have been some cases filed and some settlements, so we're going to discuss those now. The first one is going to, the first issue I'm going to cover is going to deal with school discipline and expulsion issues. And generally looking at students who have disclosed mental health conditions or a need for mental health treatment, and then as a result of that disclosure have been disciplined or expelled. So we've heard about all the horror stories about different acts of violence at schools, and obviously no one wants anything at school that's unsafe for students or teachers or anyone. And due to concerns over student suicides and possibly because of violence, some schools have implemented policies regarding students that have self-injurious behaviors or thoughts. And just to be clear, what we're going to talk about here are just cases, we're not going to be talking about any cases involving possible threats to other students. The cases we're going to look at are really going to involve students who at most may have been a threat to themselves, who have sought treatment either for symptoms of depression or other mental illness or for suicidal ideations. But none of the cases we're going to look at involve any threats or acts against other students. And what schools have done is sometimes implemented code of conduct policies prohibiting violence or dangerous behavior or requiring a leave of absence or putting policies in residential halls or housing contracts. And I think for this issue, there's a big difference between dangerous behavior or acts and merely having a diagnosis of a mental health condition. And I think that's kind of where the difference comes. And I think for schools, it's always best to focus on conduct rather than just a diagnosis. for reasons which we'll see soon. And at times, students in the cases we'll look at who exhibited no inappropriate conduct whatsoever, in fact, may have been very appropriate conduct in terms of getting treatment, have been expelled for disclosing a mental illness. And while no one wants students to be injured or there to be an unsafe environment, it does seem that myths, stereotypes, and fears regarding people with mental illness play a role in these policies and their enforcement. So students have a couple of avenues when they're challenging these. They can go to the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, or of course they can go to federal court as well. There are currently no court rulings on cases challenging these policies. Most of the cases that are filed, in fact all the ones I've been able to find, have been settled. The Department of Education Office of Civil Rights, DOEOCR for short, has ruled in one case that eviction or imposition of a mandatory leave of absence for self-injurious thoughts or behavior violates Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, and there's a cite to that complaint number at the bottom of slide 43, as well as a link to an article about that situation. And on to the next slide. I'm going to talk about some issues surrounding expulsion for conduct, and again, discipline is often taken while the student is still in the hospital. We've had some cases here at Equip for Equality, where a student was in the intensive care unit when she received a letter informing her that she was being expelled from the school. And one of the issues with this is, one, that these policies might have exactly the wrong effect. If students are punished merely for disclosing a need for mental health treatment, it may discourage students from getting the treatment that they need or desire due to the fear of the negative consequences. And I think that's a big problem. A second big problem could be that the student is now isolated from friends and support and teachers and school support systems at a time when the support may be most needed. That also sends the message that the students have done something wrong, and as we'll see, sometimes all they did was seek treatment. Just to go back to some things we've covered before, in terms of a direct threat, I do want to point out that direct threat is only listed in the regulations to Title I in employment under the DOJ regulations. There is no direct threat to others specifically listed in the regulations under Titles II or III. Some courts have applied a direct threat analysis. There is only direct threat to others under Titles II or III. I said that wrong. I apologize. There is no direct threat to self under Titles II or III. That is only recognized in Title I of the ADA in the employment setting. Some courts have taken the direct threat to self from Title I and applied it to Title II or III settings, but if you look at the Title II or III regulations, there really is no direct threat of self listed in those regulations, only direct threat to others. But in analyzing direct threats, schools must look at the duration of the risk, nature and severity of the potential harm, likelihood that the harm will occur, and the imminence of the potential harm. And that's from the Supreme Court case School Board of Nassau County versus Arline, which was codified in the Title I regulations. But again, just because I misspoke before, Title I regulations cover direct threat to self or others. In the employment setting, Titles II or III only cover direct threat to others, specifically in the regulations. And again, when looking at direct threats, schools must show that there's no reasonable accommodation that would help eliminate or alleviate a direct threat. And I have a note on the bottom which took me 12 paragraphs to explain because I misspoke, but there is the sentence there that direct threat to self is not specifically mentioned in the Title II or III regs. Next slide. So this is a case handled here at Equip for Equality with a student at Millikan University, a freshman on a music scholarship with obsessive compulsive disorder, went to talk to a dean because he had what he described as a panic attack arising from his disability. And the dean then had the student administratively withdrawn from the school with just 7 weeks left in the semester, refused to reinstate the student, and then the student came to Equip for Equality to represent him, and an ADA lawsuit was filed, and a temporary restraining order getting the student to return to school was sought for and was obtained. Next slide. After a hearing began regarding a permanent reinstatement for the student, the case was settled and the university did reinstate the student. The school agreed to expunge all references of the incident from the student's school records. And in depositions taken in that case, it really showed what was seen as an alarming lack of awareness regarding the rights of students with disabilities under the ADA, and really seen that the school's actions were based on stereotypes and speculation rather than objective evidence and facts. But that case had a happy result as the student was reinstated and all references to this incident were taken out and expunged from their records. The next case I'm going to look at was not handled by Equip for Equality. This was actually a case handled by the Bazelon Center, Knott versus George Washington University. And this student, Mr. Knott, was a close friend of another student who actually took his own life, sadly, in April of 2004. The next fall, the student went to the University Counseling Center for treatment as they themselves were experiencing insomnia and depression. Student was not suicidal and never threatened or discussed suicidal ideations, other than maybe some general suicidal thoughts, but no specific threats of suicide. And then when the student's roommate was out of town and he was alone, he checked into the George Washington University Hospital one morning for mental health treatments due to his depression. Next slide. Within hours of checking in, the student received a letter from the university stating he would not be permitted back to his dorm under the residential hall psychological distress policy. The next day, while still in the hospital, he received a letter charging him with code of conduct violations and was immediately suspended, barred from the university, and threatened with arrest if he returned to campus. The student was told that if he withdrew from school voluntarily, the suspension would not appear on his record, but that if he fought the charges and lost, he could then face suspension or expulsion, and the charges would remain on his record. Next slide. The student withdrew, transferred to another school, and then filed an ADA suit seeking damages, injunctive relief, and attorney's fees. He claimed violations of the ADA and Rehab Act and also the FHA, the Fair Housing Act, as he was removed from campus housing, and also raised issues under state anti-discrimination, tort, and confidentiality laws. I believe invasion of privacy was one of the torts raised. Another claim raised is that the information was released to administrators without permission. He checked into the health center. Oftentimes they will have a broad release authorizing the health center to communicate with administrative personnel at the university. And it is a question whether this type of waiver can or should be upheld by the courts, because also there's a blurring of the line and a violation of the student's confidentiality when they seek treatment at a health provider, and then that information is conveyed to administrative personnel at the school. And the student also raised a tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress. The case was later settled, and we have a link there to the Bazelon website, but the terms were confidential, so we don't know what the final result was. Next slide, and this is another case handled by Bazelon with Hunter College. In this case, a student admitted herself to a medical center after taking a large number of Tylenol pills and then calling 911. When she returned to the dorm, her locks were changed, and she was only allowed to remove her belongings in the presence of a security guard. The student then went to her doctors and received affirmation from them that she was not a danger to herself and others and sought to return to school, but the school would not let her return, and she filed a case under the ADA, Rehabilitation Act, and Fair Housing Act. And this case was also settled with CUNY, the Colleges of New York, City Universities of New York, paying damages to the student, attorney's fees, and agreeing to review and modify its quote-unquote suicide policy to require individualized assessments. And there's a link to the Bazelon press release on that case at the bottom of slide 51. In the next slide, Bazelon, who has handled a lot of these cases, as we've mentioned, has created a model policy for schools that contains the following suggestions. One, acknowledge but do not stigmatize mental health problems. Two, make suicide prevention a priority. And I think that's huge. I think both the schools and the students and disability advocates want to make sure that the students get the treatment they need and aren't harmed. And I think the problem is when the school punishes the students for seeking treatment by expelling them and isolates them from support system, I don't think that's going a long way to help the student in their recovery. I think suicide prevention means you don't immediately punish a student who seeks mental health treatment. That is actually something that should be encouraged. And you don't isolate them, cut them off from supports. Students should be encouraged to seek help or treatment they need. Personal information should be kept confidential. And students should be allowed to continue their education as normally as possible with receiving reasonable accommodations if appropriate. And also, according to the Bazelon's model policy, schools should refrain from discrimination against students with mental illness and avoid punitive action toward those in crisis. And that slide has a link to the Bazelon model policy. And the next slide just contains some additional policy suggestions, is avoid using discipline rules to address mental health issues. It's fine, I think, to use discipline rules to address conduct and behavior issues. But again, the cases we've looked at really were people just seeking treatment. Another suggestion is do not implement blanket policies requiring withdrawal following a mental illness disclosure or treatment. And as we know, the DOE, OCR has problems with the blanket policies, as do disability advocates. Everything requires an individualized assessment. Every case requires an individualized assessment. It's important to maintain and protect confidentiality. And then recently, an article came out that found that 25% of students who visit campus healthcare have said that they experience depression, and 10% have identified as having suicidal thoughts. And I think the point of the article is how it speaks to the stressors that are really acting at students in school and how important it is to have a policy that encourages that students get the treatment they need and to make sure that they're not punished or expelled for getting that treatment. And so we're going to leave that topic to cover our last topic of the webinar today, regarding professional licensing, disclosure, and discipline issues. And these can be seen in a wide range of professions. The next slide, some of the issues surrounding professional licensing. Many professional organizations require information on medical treatment on their licensing application, often specifying mental health treatment, asking about conditions or treatment or consultations. And it's common for many professions, social workers, attorneys, doctors, and other medical professionals, financial professionals, rehabilitation counselors, etc. Often further investigation or discipline are imposed based solely on the diagnosis or treatment history rather than being based on conduct. And Department of Justice asserts and the courts agree that state licensing boards are covered by Title II of the ADA and likely also covered by the Rehabilitation Act. Next slide, some issues with mental health questions and policies. One, and this is from an article from the Georgetown Journal of Legal Ethics that's referenced at the bottom of the slide. It perpetuates myths and stereotypes about mental illness. It may discourage disclosure and treatment. If someone knows they're going to have to disclose treatment on a licensing application, they may decide to forego treatment, even though it would be beneficial to them to receive it. Inquiries and discipline, again, are based sometimes on treatment, not conduct. Oftentimes, there's lengthy time periods involved. Some of the questions are, since age of 18 or in the past 10 years, have you consulted with anyone for a mental condition? And the problem is it may not achieve the objectives. The certifying boards usually say we need to protect people from incompetent professionals. But these types of questions might not help catch any incompetent professionals. Many people who might not be competent may not seek treatment, and so these questions would not flag them at all. And since over half the people who seek treatment for mental health issues turn out to have no mental health issues, all of a sudden everyone's being painted with a broad brush of having a significant mental illness merely by seeking some mental health treatment. So in statistical terms, the questions are called under-inclusive because it doesn't count people who may not be or who may have issues with their ability to perform their profession, and maybe over-inclusive because it's going to put extra burdens on people who might have no issues with their ability to practice their profession. And additionally, terms may not be defined. It says, for example, do you have any condition that will impact your ability to perform the essential job functions of the profession? And no matter what profession you pick, people may have very different job functions. Attorneys may go to court, they may not go to court. They may work with clients, they may not work with clients. Same thing for social workers and nurses and doctors. There are research positions. So there's a lot of broadness involved in some of this questioning. Next slide, the American Psychiatric Association, who at least I would think would say that psychiatric history is an accurate predictor of fitness, actually says the opposite. The APA, American Psychiatric Association, says psychiatric history is not an accurate predictor of fitness, except in the context of understanding current functioning. And that, I think, is kind of going to the question, say, since the age of 18, have you had any mental health treatment? And the American Bar Association recommends limiting job-related questions to information on specific behaviors, conduct, or conditions that significantly impair handling attorney responsibilities. And some of the cases we'll look at have actually pointed to these recommendations from these two organizations. So here are some questions from some of the cases that we've seen. Question one, have you ever consulted a psychiatrist, psychologist, mental health counselor, or medical practitioner for any mental, nervous, or emotional condition? Have you ever been diagnosed as having a nervous, mental, or emotional condition, or a drug or alcohol problem? Have you ever been prescribed psychotropic medication? Or do you currently have a mental health condition which in any way impairs or limits, or if untreated, could impair or limit your ability to practice law in a competent and professional manner? And the first three questions that I just read were found in the case of Ellen S. versus the Florida Board of Bar Examiners to possibly violate the ADA. It was on a motion to dismiss, which the court denied. So the court said that Ellen S. did raise a possible claim. And the fourth question, which references any impairment which, even if untreated, can impair or limit your ability to practice law, was found to violate the ADA in the case of Clark versus the Virginia Board of Bar Examiners. Next slide is we have some more questions. Have you, within the last 10 years, abused or been addicted to or treated for the use of or abuse of alcohol or any other substance? Next question, within the last 10 years, have you been diagnosed with or treated for bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, paranoia, or any other psychic disorder? And the last question, which we're going to touch on right now, have you, since attaining the age of 18 or within the last 10 years, been admitted to a hospital or other facility for treatment of bipolar or disorder, schizophrenia, paranoia? And these questions were actually upheld in the one case which did side with the board examiners, the applicants, versus the Texas State Board of Law Examiners. So those questions were upheld, although most of the cases in this area are old. And the Texas case is really the only one we found that really supported the bar examiner's questioning. So I'm sorry, going to the next slide, which has number 60 on our presentation. At least 8 states have altered mental health questions on bar applications. Illinois does not have it on their bar application. Other licensing bodies assert that the questions are needed to safeguard the public from professionals with mental impairments who may not be screened out solely by conduct-based inquiries. So then we have a query for everyone to vote. Do these questions fulfill that mission? Do they help make sure that the public is safe from incompetent professionals? So please answer yes or no whether you think this mental health questioning fulfills the mission of safeguarding the public. Control 1 for yes and control 2 for no. Okay, and a quick tally, and we see the people responding, 4% said yes, and 29% said no. So the majority says no, but some people do think the questions are helpful. And that's understandable. The questions, I think, certainly might be helpful. The question is, do they violate the ADA And are they the most helpful way of trying to make sure that professionals are able to practice properly? A note here about the Humanansky case in Minnesota. In Minnesota, mental health inquiries have been abandoned by the Medical Licensing Board in favor of conduct-based inquiries. And this one is not actually for a licensing application, so it's different than the cases we're discussing. But in Humanansky, a physician was investigated because of claims of improper conduct, including disorganized, rambling discharge summaries and inconsistency with patient care. And the court said, yeah, that's conduct, and it's conduct that's improper for a physician. It should be investigated. And I think most disability advocates would agree with that. If this conduct showing someone's not able to practice their profession, it needs to be examined. If they need accommodations to help them practice better, then those should be in place, but people do need to be able to practice their professions properly. However, most state medical licensing boards are still vigilant about monitoring prospective and active doctors' mental health status. Doctors are subject to re-licensing and work under close observation before licensing. However, some consumer groups still complain that the medical profession does not self-regulate as much as they would like. And again, some of these items are from the Georgetown Journal of Legal Ethics referenced at the bottom of the slide. Next slide is Clark versus Virginia Board of Examiners, and this is a case from 95, but I think it's still seen as one of the leading cases on the issue. And some things the court looked at: out of 10,000 bar applicants over 5 years, only 47 admitted mental health treatment, and none of those 47 applicants were barred. And the court noted that that's, you know, less than 1% of all the applicants. It seems much lower than the national average of people with mental illness. So I think they were wondering, are people just not disclosing due to fears of ramifications if they do disclose, because it is a much lower percentage than one would expect. In this case, the court required the Board of Bar Examiners to show the questions were necessary for a complete evaluation of the applicant's fitness to practice law. And the court noted that past behavior is the best indicator, that there was no correlation whatsoever between treatment and fitness, and that the inquiry is ineffective in finding and identifying unfit individuals, and it may also deter individuals from seeking treatment. And this case talked about a battle of the experts, and the plaintiff had an expert from Yale University who really tied in evidence showing that these questions do not help capture professionals who may be incompetent. And the expert for the Board of Bar Examiners, the court did not find their opinion supported at all by any evidence, so there was no correlation of any information that really helped support the bar's position in this case. It's interesting to note that the expert for the Virginia Board is actually the person who wrote the questions in the LNS case, which the court in Florida has found may violate the ADA. The court said that the bar examiners did not meet their burden. Their expert did not have justification for their position, and they could not show that the inquiries were necessary. The court cited the plaintiff's expert for there was no evidence statistically of a correlation between mental health treatment and fitness to practice or to function in the workplace. The court said the questions were overbroad and were not proven effective for weeding out unfit individuals. And the court also noted that there was considerable evidence of the stigmatizing and inhibiting effect of broad mental health questions, that they might deter individuals from seeking treatment. And the court admonished the bar examiner's failure to do an individualized assessment and ordered the questions to be rewritten to achieve the board's objective of protecting the public. The next slide is a Rhode Island case, and the Clark case, which we just talked about, in this Rhode Island case, both have great information. The Clark case also went through state by state and looked at what different states were doing at the time. And that was a federal case. This case in Rhode Island is a state case. But this case, the court appointed a special master to actually research the issue and write a report on it. And in the Rhode Island case, a question from the bar application sought information about diagnosis or treatment for quote-unquote mental disorders that affected the ability to practice law. The court compared the licensing to the employment provisions of Title I, saying that the bar committee operates as the equivalent of an employer when it screens applicants. And the court went on to say that the mental health inquiries must determine an attorney is competent while also protecting the individual applicant from unnecessary intrusions into his zone of privacy. And I think those are really the competing interests there. Make sure an attorney is competent, but not to go into private issues that don't affect competency. The court went on to say the burden is on those who propose to ask the questions to show an actual relationship, and that whole sentence was a quote, an actual relationship between the questions asked and traits that could render an attorney, quote, unqualified, end quote, or a direct threat to his or her clients, which I think is akin to the Title I showing that questions need to be necessary and criteria need to be necessary and job-related. And the court relied on a special master's report, which really went in depth on some of these issues. And the special master found that research has failed, and I'm going to be quoting here from the special master's report. Research has failed to establish that a history of previous psychiatric treatment can be correlated with an individual's capacity to function effectively in the workplace. There is no empirical evidence demonstrating that lawyers who have had psychiatric treatment have a greater incidence of subsequent disciplinary action. Most disciplinary problems and grievance issues arise after an attorney has been in practice for a number of years, and in nearly all cases, no indicators of future difficulty manifested themselves at the time of original licensure. And final quote, almost half of all Americans who seek mental health treatment do not have a diagnosable mental health problem, end quote. So the special master really thought that these questions do not help in any way. There's no evidence showing these questions help identify professionals who may not be able to uphold the profession properly. The court also noted that the initial bar application screening is done by lay individuals with no mental health training, and even went on to say, quote, even mental health practitioners would experience difficulty in predicting with accuracy the future threat posed during a lifetime of practicing law. And the holding questions were unduly intrusive, and the court ordered that the wording of the application be changed to focus on current issues and to include the word currently. So instead of have you used narcotics, it's are you currently using narcotics, drugs, or intoxicating liquors to such an extent that your ability to practice law would be impaired. And the court also gave a more detailed definition of the phrase ability to practice law. And then the other question was changed, are you currently suffering from any disorder that impairs your judgment or that would adversely affect your ability to practice law? And then I also referenced the LNS case that holding that the board was covered by Title II at the ADA. And even if the person was allowed to practice eventually, the inquiries still discriminate against plaintiffs by subjecting them to additional burdens. Often plaintiffs must sign releases and submit medical information, list their providers, and then the board will go and talk to the providers. So anyone who discloses a mental health condition is then has a lot of extra burdens placed upon them. There's a note there, the Department of Justice filed an amicus brief in support of LNS, and there's a link there to the DOJ brief. And here at Equip for Equality, I and another attorney worked in a case for a social worker who was asked whether she has any condition which impacts her ability to perform the duties of social work. And this person had a bipolar condition that was under control and she was under treatment, and I think could have answered no because her condition did not affect her ability to be a social worker. But in the interest of full disclosure, she said, yes, I have a bipolar condition. And as a result of that disclosure alone, she was placed on probation. And actually, if you went to the state's website for a period of time, it said license status, probation. You click on the reason why for probation, and it said, quote, unquote, bipolar disorder. So here the person's private medical condition was exposed on the Internet. By the licensing agency. Equip for Equality became involved, and that information was removed, and the probation was lifted, But you can imagine, once something's out on the internet, it's been very hard for this person to find a job since then, because even though the information has been removed, it's still out there somewhere. And then I want to reference this case. This is the leading case supporting the bar examiner's questioning of this. And again, no other courts have really followed this Texas case from 1994. It's a state case. They asked about treatment for bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, paranoia, or any other psychotic disorder. The courts made a broad statement. These conditions are serious mental illnesses that may affect a person's ability to practice law. And they admitted that a diagnosis will not, quote, not necessarily predict future behavior, end quote. And they also stated that the current absence of systems, quote, does not mean that the person will not experience another episode in the future, that the person is currently fit to practice law. But the court still felt just because of the nature of these conditions, they thought the questions were appropriate. However, they did not cite any medical authority to support that position, other than saying they felt that information about severe mental illness was necessary for the bar examiners. And you know, as an opinion point, this kind of strikes me as a stereotypical approach. It really wasn't supported by any mental health studies or documentation. This court kind of fell into the position that just a diagnosis alone is enough for further investigation. And so this is the leading case showing the bar examiner's position. Then we have some practical tips, and then we can throw it open for some more questions. For licensing boards, a conduct-based approach is preferable to a diagnosis or treatment-based approach. Time-limit inquiries are preferred. Look at current abilities, not the past 10 years or since you've attained the age of 18. And realize, read the information. Broad disclosure requirements do not prevent professional misconduct, are unduly intrusive, and may violate the ADA. And for these reasons, as I mentioned, Illinois does not have questions about this, instead going to a conduct-based approach. And some tips for applicants. One, do not provide false information. In Clark, the plaintiff refused to answer, and the court upheld that. But sometimes that's a hard position to take. You almost might have to go to court then to eventually get your rights vindicated. So we never encourage anyone to provide false information, but ask if you have a condition that impairs your ability, and you might have a diagnosis, but it doesn't impair your ability to practice your profession. I think you can answer no, that you don't have anything that impairs your ability, but never provide false information. Answer queer questions directly, but if a question vaguely asks about medical conditions that interfere with your ability, I don't think they need to be listed if the condition will not interfere with the applicant's ability to do the job. And again, make sure you're truthful. Just providing false information, even if the question is improper, providing false information may be grounds for disciplinary action. Next slide, we have some resources. The National Network of ADA Centers, Department of Justice, Department of Education, Equip for Equality, and the Great Lakes Disability Business Technical Assistance Center. And the next slide is back, repeat of the CLE slide for Illinois attorneys who can get CLE credit. So you email Barry at barryt@equipforequality.org. And our next legal webinar will be May 18th, Requirements and Barriers When Bringing Suit Under the ADA. And with that, I'll throw it open to questions.
And while people are typing in any other questions, and there is an evaluation form that we'd love to have you fill out, and there's the link for that, and you'll be getting that as well when you get the brief. There were some questions I tried to answer while Alan was speaking. I just want to go over those for those who weren't able to see those. A question about how recent should documentation of a learning disability and ADHD be completed? Is there still a 5-year rule for the need for current documentation? And my answer, and Alan can certainly jump in, is there's no exact time frame for documentation. Courts typically use a reasonableness standard. But I think it's in the person with disability's best interest to provide as much current information as possible.
You know, I do agree with that. I noticed one of the questions, too, up above asked if someone else can request the accommodation on a student's behalf, and I think that is entirely appropriate. Can be a family member, professional, medical provider. I think other people can request accommodations on a student's behalf.
And Alan, there was a question, I think, directed to your session, part of the session, that said, how about comments made on websites, social websites? How about used to help make cases of codes of conduct? Brian had asked that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a little different, because when someone posts something on their website, they're engaging in conduct. I think if someone said, I went to my therapist today for my depression, and then that was a basis for discipline, I think that could be problematic. But if someone typed in, I'm going to cause harm to all my classmates, I think that could be conduct that can be reacted to and dealt with appropriately. So I think it kind of depends if a student's merely disclosing a condition they have, or whether the student might be making a threat. I think there is a distinction there. So I hope that addresses the question.
And it looks like Ronald may not have heard your answer to the question before about the Redwood case. And that case was, we know that it went past the summary judgment stage and that the case went forward, but we're not sure if you got the accommodation that was needed or if whether the case was settled yet. What's challenging with these cases is that oftentimes the settlements aren't reported, or agreements to provide accommodations aren't reported, and they kind of go away. So there aren't any reported decisions, and probably the best way to figure that out would be to contact the university or the attorneys involved in the case, and even then sometimes the settlements are confidential, so you can't necessarily get all the information involved. There was another question that was asking about events by alumni groups and things like that are not necessarily on campus, and whether or not the university would be liable for those. And my initial take on that was just if it has sort of the seal of approval by the university, or the university is providing funding, or some sort of clear connection with the university, even if it's not necessarily on university property, I think potentially the university could be held liable in that scenario as well.
Yes, I agree with that, and the same thing with student groups and other items of university life unrelated to, quote unquote, the educational part. I think all those activities would also fall under that umbrella. Any other questions? I don't know if I've tried to scroll up. I see there were a lot of questions as I was talking, but
and I think there was another question that talked about should protocols change now that we have the ADA Amendments Act, and I'm not sure that protocols necessarily need to change, but I just think that the mindset of sort of focusing on whether the person has a disability, it really needs to change. And that's what the Department of Justice and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and Congress are saying. And that is, now we're not really focusing on whether the person has a disability. Obviously, you can inquire and require documentation, but courts are really going to be focusing on whether entities that are covered by the ADA are meeting their responsibilities and providing what's required. And I think we're going to see much more of a focus now, instead of on the definition of disability, on the reasonableness component. And as I referred to before, a lot of these cases were dismissed because the person couldn't show they had a disability, and I think that's not really going to be it. Now it's going to be more in the context of whether something's reasonable, whether it's an undue burden, whether it be a fundamental alteration.
And I think the other big issue is going to be related to the DOJ settlement Barry referenced. I think it might also have effect in terms of documentation for requesting accommodations at school in addition to licensing, because sometimes the requirements can be burdensome to the students and or expensive. So I think the DOJ settlement will impact what schools can request in response to accommodation requests as well.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. So Claudia, if you have any final comments you would want to make, we appreciate everybody's time today.
All right. Thank you, Barry, Ellen, and thank you, everybody else, for participating. I just want to reiterate what's on the slide here. There's the evaluation link, which will be sent to you via email after this session. I also want to remind people, if you didn't have a chance to access the materials before the session, they are posted online at ada-audio.org, and go to the legal webinar section log in, they were posted to your account. They will also be posted online in the archive section that will be next week. This session is being recorded and will be posted to the archives next week along with the materials. I also want to point out that part of the materials in today's sessions is a legal brief that Barry and Alan also refer to, and we have that brief posted on our website, and I'm posting the web address in the chat area now, adagreatlakes.org/publications/pound legal brief. You'll find today's legal brief along with previous ones that we've had for other sessions and other topics posted there as well. Just want to thank Barry and Alan once again for their time and all the great information that they provided us along with the legal briefs, and want to say thank you to everybody else. Have a good afternoon, and this concludes today's session. Thank you and have a good day.
Thank you, everybody.
To exit, just click on the X at the top right-hand area or just close your window.